This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's Beyond the Pages. The book selections for this hour are designed for middle grade and high school listeners. This program is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. My name is Lavender, and I'm happy to be with you today. I will begin reading from the book, When You Reach Me, by Rebecca Stead. Things You Keep in a Box. So, Mom got the postcard today. It says, "Congratulations," in big, curly letters, and at the very top is the address of Studio TV 15 on West 58th Street. After 3 years of trying, she has actually made it. She's going to be a contestant on the $20,000 Pyramid, which is hosted by Dick Clark. On the postcard, there's a list of things to bring. She needs some extra clothes in case she wins and makes it to another show, where they pretend it's the next day, even though they really tape 5 in one afternoon. Barrettes are optional, but she should definitely bring some with her. Unlike me, Mom has glossy red hair that bounces around and might obstruct America's view of her small, freckled face. And then there's the date she's supposed to show up, scrawled in blue pen on a line at the bottom of the card. April 27th, 1979. Just like you said, I check the box under my bed, which is where I've kept your notes these past few months. There it is, in your tiny handwriting. April 27th, Studio TV 15, the words all jerky-looking, like you wrote them on the subway. Your last proof. I still think about the letter you asked me to write. It nags at me, even though you're gone and there's no one to give it to anymore. Sometimes I work on it in my head, trying to map out the story you asked me to tell about everything that happened this past fall and winter. It's all still there, like a movie I can watch when I want to, which is never. Things That Go Missing. Mom has swiped a big paper calendar from work and scotch-taped the month of April to the kitchen wall. She used a fat green marker, also swiped from work, to draw a pyramid on April 27th with dollar signs and exclamation points all around it. She went out and bought a fancy egg timer that can accurately measure a half minute. They don't have fancy egg timers in the supply closet at her office. April 27th is also Richard's birthday. Mom wonders if that's a good omen. Richard is Mom's boyfriend. He and I are going to help Mom practice every single night, which is why I'm sitting at my desk instead of watching after-school TV, which is a birthright of every latchkey child. Latchkey child is a name for a kid with keys who hangs out alone after school until a grown-up gets home to make dinner. Mom hates that expression. She says it reminds her of dungeons and must have been invented by someone strict and awful with an unlimited child care budget. Probably someone German, she says, glaring at Richard, who is German but not strict or awful. It's possible. In Germany, Richard says I would be one of the Schlüsselkinder, which means key children. You're lucky, he tells me. Keys are power. Some of us have to come knocking. It's true that he doesn't have a key. Well, he has a key to his apartment, but not to ours. Richard looks the way I picture guys on sailboats. Tall, blonde, and very tucked in, even on weekends. Or maybe I picture guys on sailboats that way because Richard loves to sail. His legs are very long, and they don't really fit under our kitchen table, so he has to sit kind of sideways with his knees pointing out toward the hall. He looks especially big next to Mom, who's short and so tiny she has to buy her belts in the kids' department and make an extra hole in her watch band so it won't fall off her arm. Mom calls Richard Mr. Perfect because of how he looks and how he knows everything. And every time she calls him Mr. Perfect, Richard taps his right knee. He does that because his right leg is shorter than his left one. All his right foot shoes have 2-inch platforms nailed to the bottom so that his legs match. In bare feet, he limps a little. You should be grateful for that leg, Mom tells him. It's the only reason we let you come around. Richard has been coming around for almost 2 years now. We have exactly 21 days to get Mom ready for the game show. So instead of watching television, I'm copying words for her practice session tonight. I write each word on one of the white index cards Mom swiped from work. When I have 7 words, I bind the cards together with a rubber band she also swiped from work. I hear Mom's keys in the door and flip over my word piles so she can't peek. Miranda? She clomps down the hall. She's on a clog kick lately and sticks her head in my room. Are you starving? I thought we'd hold dinner for Richard. I can wait. The truth is, I've just eaten an entire bag of cheese doodles. After school, junk food is another functional right of the latchkey child. I'm sure this is true in Germany, too. You're sure you're not hungry? Want me to cut up an apple for you? What's a kind of German junk food? I ask her. Wiener Krispies? She stares at me. I have no idea. Why do you ask? No reason. Do you want the apple or not? No, and get out of here. I'm doing the words for later. Great, she smiles and reaches into her coat pocket. Catch! She logs something towards me, and I grab what turns out to be a bundle of brand new markers in rainbow colors held together with a fat rubber band. She clomps back toward the kitchen. Richard and I figured out a while ago that the more stuff Mom swipes from the office supply closet, the more she's hating work. I look at the markers for a second and then get back to my word piles. Mom has to win this money. Things you hide. I was named after a criminal. Mom says that's a dramatic way of looking at things, but sometimes the truth is dramatic. The name Miranda stands for people's rights, she said last fall when I was upset because Robbie B. had told me during gym that I was named after a kidnapper. I had left my keys at school and waited 2.5 hours at Bell's Market on Amsterdam Avenue for Mom to get home from work. I didn't mind the waiting so much. I helped Belle out around the store for a while, and I had my book, of course. Still reading that same book? Belle asked, once I had settled into my folding chair next to the cash register to read. It's looking pretty beat up. I'm not still reading it, I told her. I'm reading it again. I had probably read it 100 times, which was why it looked so beat up. Okay, Belle said. So let's hear something about this book. What's the first line? I never judge a book by the cover, she said. I judge by the first line. I knew the first line of my book without even looking. It was a dark and stormy night, I said. She nodded. Classic. I like that. What's the story about? I thought for a second. It's about a girl named Meg. Her dad is missing, and she goes on this trip to another planet to save him. And does she have a boyfriend? Sort of, I said, but that's not really the point. How old is she? 12. The truth is that my book doesn't say how old Meg is, but I am 12, so she feels 12 to me. When I first got the book, I was 11, and she felt 11. Oh, 12, Belle said. Plenty of times for boyfriends then. Why don't you start from the beginning? Start what from the beginning? The story. Tell me the story from the beginning. So I started telling her the story of my book. Not reading it to her, just telling her about it, starting with the first scene where Meg wakes up at night, afraid of a thunderstorm. While she listened, Belle made me a turkey sandwich and gave me about 10 chewable vitamin C's because she thought I sounded nasal. When she went to the bathroom, I sneaked a little bunch of grapes, which I love but can't ever have, because Mom doesn't like the way the grape pickers are treated in California, and she refuses to buy them. When she finally got there, Mom hugged Belle and told her, "I owe you," like I was some repulsive burden instead of the person who had very helpfully unpacked 3 boxes of green bananas and scoured the refrigerated section in expired dairy items. Then Mom bought a box of strawberries, even though I know she thinks Belle's strawberries are overpriced and not very good. She calls them SSOs, which stands for strawberry-shaped objects. Where did Robbie B. get the dumb idea that anyone would name her own daughter after a murderer? Mom asked. Our building was still half a block away, but our key was already in her hand. Mom doesn't like to fumble around in front of the building looking like a target for muggers. Sorry. Not a murderer, I said, a kidnapper. Robbie B's dad is a prosecutor. He says the Miranda warnings were named for a guy named Mr. Miranda who committed some horrible crime. Is that true? Technically, maybe. The Miranda warnings are essential, you know. People need to know that they have the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. What kind of justice system would we have without... Maybe meaning yes? And then there's Shakespeare. He invented the name Miranda, you know, for The Tempest. It made perfect sense now that I thought about it. Mom wanted to be a criminal defense lawyer. She started law school and almost finished her first year, but then I was born and she had to quit. Now she's a paralegal, except she works at a really small law office where she has to be the receptionist and the secretary, too. Richard is one of the lawyers. They do a lot of free work for poor people, sometimes even for criminals. But I never dreamed she would name me after one. Mom unlocked the lobby door, which is iron and glass and must weigh 300 pounds, and she pushed hard to swing it open, her heels slipping on the tile floor. When we were inside, she leaned against the other side of the door until she heard the click that means the lock has caught. When the door swings shut by itself, it usually doesn't rock, which drives Mom nuts and is one of the things the landlord won't fix. So, was he a kidnapper or not? I punched the button for the elevator. Okay, you win, Mom said. I named you after a monster, Miranda. I'm sorry. If you don't like your name, you are welcome to change it. That was so, Mom. She didn't understand that a person gets attached to a person's name, that something like this might come as a shock. Upstairs, she threw her coat on a kitchen chair, filled the spaghetti pot with water, and put it on to boil. She was wearing an orange turtleneck and a denim skirt with purple and black striped tights. "Nice tights," I snorted. Or I tried to snort. Anyway, I'm not exactly sure how, though people in books are always doing it. She leaned against the sink and flipped through the mail. "You already hassled me about the tights this morning, Miranda." "Oh." She was usually still in bed when I left for school, so I didn't get to appreciate her outfit until she got home from work. "Nice nail polish, then." Her nails were electric blue. She must have done them at her desk that day. She rolled her eyes. "Are you mad about waiting at Bell's? I was super busy. I couldn't just leave." "No, I like it at Bell's." I wondered whether she'd done her nails before, after, or during her super busy afternoon. "You could have gone to Sal's, you know." Sal and his mom, Louisa, live in the apartment below ours. Sal used to be my best friend. "I said I like it at Bell's." "Still, I think we should hide a key in the fire hose for the next time." So after dinner, we hid our spare key inside the nozzle of the dusty, folded-up fire hose in the stairwell. The hose is all cracked-looking and about 100 years old, and Mom always says that if there's an actual fire, it will be of no use whatsoever, and we'll have to jump out the window into the neighbor's garden. It's a good thing we live on the second floor. You asked me to mention the key. If I ever do decide to write your letter, which I probably won't, this is the story I would tell you. The Speed Round. There are two parts to the $20,000 pyramid. Mom calls the first part the Speed Round because it's all about speed. Contestants try to make their celebrity partners guess 7 common words by giving clues. So if the first word is fork, a contestant might say, "You use this to put food in your mouth, not a spoon, but a..." If he has a brain, which Mom says he might not, the celebrity partner will say fork, and then there'll be a ding, and the next word will show up on a little hidden screen. Each team gets 30 seconds for 7 words. Then the little screens swivel around, and it's the celebrity's turn to give the clues and the contestant's turn to guess. Another 7 words, another 30 seconds. Then the screens swivel back, and the contestants give the clues again. There are a possible 21 points in the speed round, and a perfect score earns a cash bonus of $2,100. But the most important thing is just to beat the other team, because the team that wins the speed round goes to the winner's circle. And the winner's circle is where the big money is. There isn't a lot of time for practice tonight because it's tenant meeting night. Once a month, the neighbors sit in our living room and complain while Mom takes notes in shorthand. Most people don't bother to come. It's always the old folks who don't get asked to go many places and are mad that there isn't more heat. Sal's mom, Louisa, works in a nursing home, and she says old people can never get enough heat. After the meetings, during which Mr. Nunzi has usually burned a new hole in our couch with a cigarette, Mom always writes a letter to the landlord and sends a copy to some city agency that's supposed to care whether we have hot water, if the lobby door locks, and that the elevator keeps getting stuck between floors. But nothing ever changes. Our doorbell is going to start ringing any minute. Mom is running through a few speed rounds with Richard while I make lemonade from frozen concentrate and open the Oreos. Louisa knocks her regular knock, and I answer the door with the plate of cookies. She takes an Oreo and sighs. She's wearing jeans with her white nurse shoes, which she kicks off by the door. She hates these meetings, but comes out of loyalty to Mom. And someone has to watch Mr. Nunzi's cigarette to make sure he doesn't accidentally set our apartment on fire. Lemonade, I ask. I refuse to play waitress during Mom's get-togethers, but I'll pour Louisa a drink anytime. Lemonade sounds lovely. She follows me to the kitchen. Just as I put the glass in her hand, the doorbell buzzes for about a minute straight. Why do they have to hold the button down forever? Old people, Louisa says, as if she can read my mind. They're so used to being ignored. She grabs two more cookies and goes to answer the door. Louisa doesn't normally eat what she calls processed foods, but she says she could never get through a tenant meeting without Oreos. 15 minutes later, Mom is sitting on the living room floor, writing furiously as everyone takes turns saying that the elevator is dirty, there are cigarette butts on the stairs, and the dryer in the basement melted somebody's elastic waist pants. I lean against the wall in the hallway and watch her hold up one finger to signal Mrs. Bindocker to slow down. Once Mrs. Bindocker gets going, not even Mom's shorthand can keep up with her. Mom cried the first time she saw our apartment. The whole place was filthy, she says. The wood floors were practically black. The windows were caked with dirt, and the walls were smeared with something she didn't even want to think about. Always in those same words, I was there that day in a little bucket seat baby carrier. It was cold out, and she had a new coat on. There were no hangers in the closets, and she didn't want to put the coat down on the dirty floor or drape it over one of the peeling, hissing radiators. So she carried it while she went from room to room, telling herself it wasn't so awful. At this point in the story, I used to try to think of some place she could have put her coat, if only she had thought of it. Why didn't you drape it over the rod in the hall closet, I'd ask. Dusty, she'd say. On the windowsill in the kitchen. Dusty. What about over the top of the bedroom door? Couldn't reach, she'd say. And dusty. What Mom did that day, almost 12 years ago, was put her coat back on, pick up my bucket seat, and walk to a store where she bought a mop, some soap, garbage bags, a roll of sticky shelf paper, sponges, a bottle of window spray, and paper towels. Back home, she dumped everything out onto the floor. Then she folded her coat and slid it into the empty bag from the store. She hung the bag on a doorknob and cleaned the apartment all afternoon. I knew enough, she says, to snuggle down in my bucket seat and take a very long nap. She met Louisa, who didn't have a husband either, in the lobby on that first day. They were both taking garbage to the big cans out front. Louisa was holding Sal. Sal had been crying, but when he saw me, he stopped. I know all this because I used to ask to hear the story over and over, the story of the day I met Sal. Things That Kick. Losing Sal was like a long list of bad things, and somewhere in the top half of the list was the fact that I had to walk home alone past the crazy guy on our corner. He showed up around the beginning of the school year when Sal and I still walked home from school together. A few kids called him Quack, short for Quackers, or they called him Kicker because he used to do these sudden kicks into the street, like he was trying to putt one of the cars speeding up Amsterdam Avenue. Sometimes he shook his fist at the sky and yelled crazy stuff like, "What's the burn scale? Where's the dome?" And then he threw his head back and laughed, these loud, crazy laughs, so everyone could see that he had about 30 fillings in his teeth. And he was always on our corner, sometimes sleeping with his head under the mailbox. "Don't call him Quack," Mom said. "That's an awful name for a human being."
"Even a human being who's Quackers?"
"I don't care. It's still awful."
"Well, what do you call him?"
"I don't call him anything," she said, "but I think of him as the Laughing Man." Back when I still walked home with Sal, it was easier to pretend that the Laughing Man didn't scare me, because Sal was pretending too. He tried not to show it, but he freaked when he saw the Laughing Man shaking his fist at the sky and kicking his leg out into traffic. I could tell by the way Sal's face kind of froze. I know all of his expressions. I used to think of Sal as being a part of me. Sal and Miranda. Miranda and Sal. I knew he wasn't, really, but that's the way it felt. When we were too little for school, Sal and I went to daycare together at a lady's apartment down the block. She had picked up some carpet samples at a store on Amsterdam Avenue and written the kids' names on the backs. After lunch, she'd pass out these carpet squares, and we'd pick our spots on the living room floor for nap time. Sal and I always lined ours up to make a rectangle. One time, when Sal had a fever and Louisa had called in sick to her job and kept him home, the daycare lady handed me my carpet square at nap time, and then a second later, she gave me Sal's too. "I know how it is, baby," she said. And then I lay on her floor, not sleeping because Sal wasn't there to press his foot against mine. When he first showed up on our corner last fall, the Laughing Man was always mumbling under his breath, "Book bag pocket shoe, book bag pocket shoe." He said it like a chant, "Book bag pocket shoe, book bag pocket shoe." And sometimes he would be hitting himself on the head with his fists. Sal and I used to try to get really interested in our conversation and act like we didn't notice. It's crazy the things a person can pretend not to notice. "Why do you think he sleeps like that, with his head under the mailbox?" I asked Richard back when the Laughing Man was brand new and I was still trying to figure him out.
"I don't know," Richard said, looking up from the paper.
"Maybe so nobody steps on his head."
"Very funny. And what's a pocket shoe anyway?"
"Pocket shoe," he said, looking serious. "Noun. An extra shoe you keep in your pocket, in case someone steals one of yours while you're asleep with your head under the mailbox."
"Ha, ha, ha," I said.
"Oh, Mr. Perfect," Mom said. "You and your amazing dictionary head." She was in one of her good moods that day. Richard tapped his right knee and went back to his newspaper. Things That Get Tangled. Lucky for Mom, some of the old people at the nursing home where Louisa works like to watch the $20,000 pyramid at lunchtime. Louisa takes notes on every show and brings them over after work. She gets off at 4, so I have time to write out the day's words on stolen index cards before Mom gets home. Tonight, Mom and Richard are practicing in the living room. I'm supposed to be doing homework in my room, but instead, I'm tying knots and I'm thinking. It was Richard who taught me how to tie knots.
He learned back when he sailed boats as a kid, and he still carries pieces of rope in his briefcase. He says that when he's trying to solve a problem at work, he takes out the ropes, ties them into knots, unties them, and then ties them again. It gets him in the right frame of mind. 2 Christmases ago, which was his first Christmas with us, Richard gave me my own set of ropes and started showing me knots. Now I can make every knot he knows, even the clove hitch, which I did backward for a few months before I got it right. So I am tying and untying knots and seeing if it helps me solve my problem, which is you. I have no idea what you expect from me. If you just wanted to know what happened that day this past winter, it would be easy. Not fun, but easy. But that's not what your note says. It says to write down the story of what happened and everything that led up to it. And as Mom likes to say, that's a whole different bucket of poop. Except she doesn't use the word poop. Because even if you were still here, even if I did decide to write the letter, I wouldn't know where to start. The day the Laughing Man showed up on our corner, the day Mom and Louisa met in the lobby, the day I found your first note, there is no answer. But if someone sat on my legs and forced me to name the day the whole true story began, I'd say it was the day Sal got punched. So obviously this book is very confusing. You must be wondering, who is she writing to? And I'm assuming that she is writing to the person, I don't know, somebody who keeps sending her notes. You must be wondering, who is the Laughing Man? Who is that weird guy that, like, stands on the corner and sleeps under their mailbox? He's a very important character. I actually read this book when I was 15 years old, which was 15 years ago, actually. So, I mean, I know some of the answers of some of the questions that you're asking because I read this book before, but I'm not giving it away. Things That Stain. It happened in the fall when Sal and I still walked home from school together every single day, one block from West End Avenue to Broadway, one block from Broadway to Amsterdam, past the Laughing Man on our corner, and then half a block to our lobby door. That middle block between Broadway and Amsterdam is mostly a huge garage where the sidewalk is all slanted, and we had to be careful when it was icy or else we'd slip right in front of the pack of boys always hanging out there. If we did fall, they'd make a really big deal out of it, staggering around laughing and sometimes calling us names that made our hearts beat fast the rest of the way home. The day Sal got punched, there was no ice on the ground because it was only October. I was carrying the big oak tag Mysteries of Science poster I'd made at school. I had drawn big bubble letters for the title, which was Why Do We Yawn? There are a lot of interesting theories about yawning. Some people think it started as a way of showing off the teeth to scare predators away, or as a way to stretch facial muscles, or to signal the rest of the tribe that it's time to sleep. My own theory, which I included on my poster, is that yawning is a semi-polite way of telling someone that they're boring everyone to death. Either that, or it's a slow-motion sneeze. But no one knows for sure, which is why it's a mystery of science. The day Sal got punched, the boys by the garage were hanging out as usual. The day before, there had been a fight, with one of them slamming another one up against a parked car and hitting him. The kid getting hit had both his hands up, like he was saying, "Enough!" But every time he tried to get off the hood of that car, the other kid pushed him down and hit him again.
The other boys were all jumping around and yelling, and Sal and I had crossed to the other side of the street so that we wouldn't get accidentally slammed by somebody. On the day Sal got punched, the boys were being regular, so we stayed on our usual side. But just as we started past the garage, someone moved away from the group. He took a big step toward me and Sal and blocked our way so that we had to stop. I looked up and saw a not-too-biggish kid in a green army coat. He made a fist that came up like a wave and hit Sal right in the stomach, hard. Sal doubled over and gurgled like he was going to throw up. And then the kid whacked him across the face. "Sal!" I yelled. I glanced over at Bell's Market on Amsterdam, but no one was out front. Sal was bent over and frozen. The kid just stood there for a few seconds with his head tilted to one side. It seemed crazy, but it actually looked like he was reading my Mysteries of Science poster. Then he turned away and started strolling toward Broadway like nothing had happened. "Sal!" I leaned over to see his face, which looked okay but had one cheek all red. "Walk," I said. "We're almost home." Sal's feet started to move. It took me a few steps to realize that the boys weren't laughing or whistling or calling us names. They hadn't made a sound. I looked back and saw them standing there, staring after the kid in the green army coat, who was still walking in the other direction.
"Hey!" one of them yelled down the block after him. "What the hell was that?"
But the kid didn't look back. Sal was moving slowly. He squeezed the arms of the blue satin Yankees jacket Louisa got him for his birthday, and tears were dropping down his face, and I almost cried, but I didn't. It was my job to get him home, and we still had to get by the laughing man. He was on our corner, marching around in a circle and doing some salutes. Sal was crying harder and walking in a hunch. Some blood had started dripping out of his nose, and he wiped it with the blue and white striped cuff of his jacket. He gagged a lot. It sounded like he really might throw up. When he saw us, the laughing man dropped his arms to his sides and stood up straight. He reminded me of the big wooden nutcracker Louisa puts out on her kitchen table at Christmas time.
"Smart kid," he said.
He took a step toward us, and it was enough to make Sal take off running for home. I ran after him, trying to hold on to my poster and get my keys out of my jeans. When I had gotten us into the lobby, Sal went straight to his apartment and closed the door on me. I knocked for a while, but Louisa wasn't home from work yet, and he wouldn't let me in. If I'm not wrong, this is the beginning of the story you wanted me to tell. And I didn't know it yet, but it was also the end of my friendship with Sal. Mom's Rules for Life in New York City. Always have your key out before you reach the front door. If a stranger is hanging out in front of the building, don't ever go in. Just keep walking around the block until he's gone. Look ahead. If there's someone acting strange down the block, looking drunk or dangerous, cross to the other side of the street. But don't be obvious about it. Make it look like you were planning to cross the street all along. Never show your money on the street. I have my own trick. If I'm afraid of someone on the street, I'll turn to him, it's always a boy, and say, "Excuse me, do you happen to know what time it is?" This is my way of saying to the person, I see you as a friend, and there is no need to hurt me or take my stuff. Also, I don't even have a watch, and I am probably not worth mugging. So far, it's worked like gangbusters, as Richard would say. And I've discovered that most people I'm afraid of are actually very friendly. Things you wish for. Miranda, Mom calls from the kitchen. We need you to keep time. This egg timer ticking is driving me crazy. So I watch the second hand of the kitchen clock while Richard feeds Mom clues. Then Mom gives the clues while Richard guesses. Can I play? I ask after about 5 rounds. Sure, Richard, you keep time for a while. Mom stretches and peels off her purple sweatshirt. As it goes over her head, her hair falls free of the collar and bounces down around her shoulders. As usual, this makes me curse my non-existent dad, who must be to blame for my hair, which is straight, brown, and just kind of there. I blame this stupid flat brown hair on my father, but otherwise, I don't hold any grudges against him. In my book, Meg is looking for her father. When she finally gets to Kamazots, which is a planet somewhere near the Big Dipper, where he's being held prisoner, this evil man with red eyes asks her why she wants him, and she says, "Didn't you ever have a father yourself? You don't want him for a reason. You want him because he's your father." So I figure it's because I never had a father that I don't want one now. A person can't miss something she never had. Richard is looking at the kitchen clock, waiting for the second hand to get to the 12. Okay, get ready, go! I look down at the first card. This is something you spread on toast, I say. Butter, Mom yells. Next card. You drink a milkshake with this. You suck through it. A straw, Mom yells. Next. It's leather and it holds your pants up. A belt. It's sweet. You drink it in winter after you go sledding. Hot chocolate. It's good to play, to think of nothing but the next word, and to have Mom think of nothing but the next words out of my mouth. We fly through the pack of 7 words. You're good at this, Mom says when we finish with 5 seconds to spare. I'm smiling. I really think you're going to win, I tell her. Don't get your hopes up, she warns. This is just the speed round. The speed round is the easy part. The truth is that our hopes are already up. Our wish list is stuck to the fridge with a magnet Mom stole from work. Trip to China. Good camera for trip to China. Wall-to-wall carpeting for Miranda's room. New TV, and Richard has scribbled sailboat at the bottom. Though it's hard to imagine where we would park it. That's the official list anyway. Richard and I have our own secret plan for the money, if Mom wins it. Things that sneak up on you. The day Sal got punched, back in October, Louisa came upstairs after dinner to have a conference with Mom in her bedroom. They decided that Sal needed a mental health day, which meant he was allowed to skip school and watch TV the next day. So the following afternoon, I walked home alone. I was doing a lot of talking in my head so that I would be deep in conversation with myself by the time I got to the Laughing Man. I was almost to the garage when I realized someone was walking right behind me. I glanced back and saw the kid who punched Sal. He was maybe 2 feet away, wearing the same green army jacket he had worn the day before. I was about to panic. I always know when I'm about to panic because my knees and neck both start to tingle. And then, before I had really decided what to do, I turned around to face him.
"Excuse me, do you happen to know what time it is?"
My voice sounded almost normal. That was good.
"Let's see," he turned his head and looked back toward Broadway, like maybe there was a giant clock hovering in the air right behind us. "It's 3:16. I nodded like I could see the invisible clock, too.
"Thanks."
He didn't look like he was about to hit me, but still, my heart was pounding. He pointed. "See that big brown building? Yesterday, the sun started to go behind it at 3:12. Now it's about halfway gone." He glanced at me. "Plus, it's one day later, and it's October, so the days are getting shorter."
I stared at him. He looked down at his hand, which held a key. He pushed the other hand into his pants pocket.
"I don't have a watch," he said.
"Oh," I said.
"Me neither."
He nodded, and I wasn't afraid anymore. But as soon as the fear was gone, I filled up with guilt.
"Look at you," my brain said, "chatting with the kid who punched Sal."
My brain has a way of talking to me like that.
"I've got to go," I said, and I didn't let myself glance back until I got to the corner. When I did, the kid who punched Sal was gone. That was when I realized that he must live in the apartment over the garage, the one with dead plants on the fire escape and bedsheets hanging over the windows. I'd forgotten all about the laughing man. His legs were sticking out from under the mailbox, and I was careful not to wake him.
Things that bounce. After he got punched, Sal started playing basketball in the alley behind our building. Our living room windows face that way, and I heard him dribbling his ball back there from about 3:30 to 5 every day. There was a rusted-out metal hoop with no net that made a clanging sound whenever he hit it. Sal and Luisa's apartment is mostly the same as ours. We have the same rectangular bedrooms, the same pull-chain light in the hallway, the same weird-shaped kitchen with the same unpredictable ovens. Theirs right below ours. There are differences. Their kitchen floor is yellow and orange linoleum squares instead of the white with gold flakes that we have, and Sal's bed is up against a different wall in the bedroom. But we have the same bathroom floor, these white hexagonal tiles. If I look at them long enough, I can see all kinds of patterns in those hexagons, lines, arrows, even flowers. They kind of shift into these different pictures. It's the sort of thing a person would never try to explain to anyone else. But once, when we were little, I told Sal about it, and then we went into his bathroom to stare at the floor together. Sal and Miranda. Miranda and Sal. Sal played basketball more and more and talked to me less and less. I asked him 400 times whether he was okay or if he was mad at me or what was wrong, and 399 times he answered yes, no, and nothing. Then the last time I asked, he told me while standing in our lobby and looking at his feet that he didn't want to have lunch or walk home together for a while.
"Do you even want to be friends at all?"
I asked him. He glared at his feet and said no. He guessed he didn't for a while. I was lucky, I guess, that this was the same week Julia decided to punish Anna Marie for something. The girls at school had been hurting each other's feelings for years before Sal left me, and I was forced to really notice them. I had watched them trade best friends, start wars, cry, trade back, make treaties, squeal, and grab each other's arms in this fake, excited way, etc., etc. I had seen which ones tortured Alice Evans, who, even though we'd started sixth grade, still waited too long to pee and never wanted to say out loud that she had to go. These girls would wait until Alice was pretty far gone, jiggling one foot and then the other, and then they would start asking her questions. Alice, they'd say, did you do today's page in the math workbook yet, where it says multiply to check your answer? How did you do that? And she'd desperately hop around while showing them. I knew the way the girls always paired up, and Julia and Anna Marie had been paired up for a long time. Julia, I hated. Anna Marie, I had never thought about much. My first memory of Julia is from second grade, when we made self-portraits and art. She complained there was no cafe au lait colored construction paper for her skin or 60% cacao chocolate color for her eyes. I remember staring at her while these words came out of her mouth and thinking, your skin is light brown. Your eyes are dark brown. Why don't you just use brown, you idiot? Jay Stringer didn't complain about the paper, and neither did any of the other 10 kids using brown. I didn't complain about the stupid hot pink color I'd been given. Did my skin look hot pink to her? But I soon found out that Julia wasn't like the rest of us. She took trips all over the world with her parents. She would disappear from school, and now, up 2 weeks later, with satin ribbons worked into her braids, or with a new green velvet scoop neck dress, or wearing 3 gold rings on one finger. She learned about 60% cacao chocolate, she said, in Switzerland, where her parents had bought her a lot of it, along with a little silver watch she was always shoving in people's faces. I still don't know what Anna Marie did wrong. But during silent reading period that Tuesday, Julia told her that, as punishment, she wasn't going to have lunch with Anna Marie for the remainder of the week. Julia was big on announcing things in a loud voice so that everyone could hear. So on Wednesday, I asked Anna Marie if she wanted to go out to lunch with me, and she said yes. In sixth grade, kids with any money, even just a little, go out for lunch unless something is going on, and they won't let us, like the first week of school when there was a man running down Broadway stark naked, and we all had to eat in the school cafeteria while the police tried to catch him. Mostly kids go to the pizza place, or to McDonald's, or every once in a while, to the sandwich place, which has a real name, but which we called Jimmy's because there was never anyone working there except one guy called Jimmy. Pizza is the best deal. $1.50 will buy 2 slices, a can of soda, and a cherry blow pop from the candy bucket next to the register. That first day together, Anna Marie and I got lucky and found 2 stools next to each other at the counter under the flag of Italy. I found it slightly gross to eat pizza with Anna Marie because she peeled the cheese off her slice like a scab and ate it, leaving everything else on her plate. But she laughed at my jokes, which I mostly stole from Richard, who is bad at telling jokes but knows a lot of them, and she invited me over to her house after school, which more than made up for it. I would be spared an afternoon of listening to Sal's basketball, and the laughing man might be asleep under his mailbox by the time I walked home. Things that burn. Anna Marie's apartment didn't involve keys. Instead, she had a doorman who slapped her 5 and a dad who opened the door upstairs. Did your dad take the day off? I whispered. No, Anna Marie said. He works from home. He illustrates medical journals. Is your mom here too? She shook her head. She's at work. Anna Marie's bedroom was about the same size as mine, but it had nice curtains and the walls were completely covered with all kinds of pictures and photographs, which I couldn't stop looking at. There must have been 100 of them. We've known each other for a long time, Anna Marie said, sitting down on her bed, which had some kind of Asian bedspread and about 50 pillows on it.
Who?
She blushed.
Oh, I thought you were looking at the pictures of Julia.
That's when I noticed that her room was covered with pictures of Julia. Maybe not covered exactly, but there were a lot of them, the two of them in pajamas or in the park or standing together all dressed up outside some theater.
Knock, knock.
Anna Marie's dad came in with these tiny sausages on a plate.
I'm on deadline, he said to me. When I'm on deadline, I cook. Do you like mustard? Try the dipping sauce. I'll be right back with some apple cider.
He was back in 30 seconds with a glass of cider for me, but he handed Anna Marie what looked like plain water. She didn't seem to notice. Anna Marie's rug was spongy and soft, almost like another bed, and I lay down on it. Mustard always makes my lips burn, but I didn't care. It was worth it.
Well, folks, that's all the time we have for today.
This Beyond the Pages program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I hope you will join us next time for Beyond the Pages. If you have any ideas or comments, we'd love to hear from you. I'm Lavender. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is I Remember, I Remember, by Thomas Hood. I remember the house where I was born, the little window where the sun came peeping in at morn. He never came a wink too soon, nor brought too long a day. But now I often wish the night had borne my breath away. I remember the roses red and white, the violets and the lily cups, those flowers made of light. The lilacs where the robin built, and where my brother set the laburnum on his birthday. The tree is living yet. I remember where I used to swing, and thought the air must rush as fresh to swallows on the wing. My spirit flew in feathers then, that is so heavy now, and summer pools could hardly cool the fever on my brow. I remember the fir trees dark and high. I used to think their slender tops were close against the sky. It was a childish ignorance, but now 'tis little joy to know I'm farther off from heaven than when I was a boy. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal and read by Nikki Wichelow. Thanks for listening. May your life be filled with poetic wonder.
The best way to avoid a scam is to talk about it, even if you're not sure it's a scam. Talking about the phone calls and emails you get can help you and helps those you care about. Someone might ask you for money or personal information, but do you really know who's behind that email or on the phone? They may not be who you think they are. Someone might want you to act now to give them money or personal information before you have time to think about it. Tell that person you need time. Then, talk to someone you trust before you do anything else. Remember to call BBB if you suspect a scam or want to report a scam, even if you don't lose money. your scam report will help prevent additional victims. Our toll-free number is 1-866-566-9222.